netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Available now from FXPhD.com, all new speed grade fast forward training. Download immediately all 10 classes and footage covering CS6 speed grade. Check it out at FXPhD.com. Hi, and welcome to this special FX podcast. This is our podcast that looks behind the headlines, behind the press releases at things that are going on in the industry. But this week, something different. We're going to be doing a rebroadcast of an edit of a show I did a couple of years ago with Marty Rosenberg. On September 29th, 30th, and October 1st of this year, FX PhD is running a three-day effects seminar at the old ILM model shop. So it's going to be absolutely awesome. We're going to be filming explosions, effects, debris, green screen, and more with an amazing set of talented traditional and digital artists, including three-time Oscar nominee Scott Squires and Marty Rosenberg. Marty has a 20-year set of credits as an effects DOP from work that he did with ILM and then Kerner Optical in both films and commercials. His effects photography can be seen in stuff like Hunt for Red October, Mission Impossible, Star Wars Episodes 1, 2, and 3, War of the Worlds, Jarhead, AI, Artificial Intelligence, Terminator Salvation, Last Airbender, and Red Tails. As we only just announced this new workshop, the FX 2012 workshop happening at the 3010 Studios, we thought you might like to hear again Marty talk about filming effects, especially the elements, as he likes to call them, which is fire, water, and earth. If you want to find out more about the seminar, check it out at fxguide.com or at fxphd.com. You can buy tickets now, though there aren't many places left. I must admit, even by the time you hear this, they may be sold out. But anyway, we thought you'd enjoy listening to this interview I did with Marty. This is recorded just after Kerner had split from ILM. And as I say, we'll be filming with Marty at this open seminar, which you can buy tickets to attend at the end of September in San Rafael. And Marty, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
So obviously the company has changed a little in recent times. I guess from one perspective, it's the most illustrious long history of a company that only just started. Maybe you can explain what's happened in the last 12 to 14 months.
Sure. That was well put. We are now Kerner Optical Company. Kerner Optical Company is the offshoot, and really what it was the practical effects division as it aged over the years of ILM. Of course, when ILM started 25, 30 years ago, all we did was practical work. Over the time period, ILM became very heavy into CG. Maybe if you put a percent on it, 75%, but you know, you never could just do a percent, but it was a lot. But we still did a lot of miniatures and everything that was involved with practical or photographed effects. George Lucas decided to sell the company. There are many reasons which I won't even try to go into. The bottom line is he did. One of which was space, and he decided to move, and you couldn't move the stages into San Francisco, so it wasn't even attempted, so we're still in San Rafael. So Mark Anderson and a group of people, a few investors, bought the practical division. It consists of the three, four stages we have here in the same lot that ILM used to be in at Kerner. The name Kerner is derived from the street we're on. We have stages. We have a model shop. We have all sorts of building shops and what we call an effects division that does practical rigs. We have a camera engineering department that built and no longer builds, but now maintains the cameras they built, the VistaVision cameras over the years. And we're in business now to do what comes along. Our forte, of course, is effects for films. We like to do commercials. We've done them in the past, both full live-action commercials and those involved with effects. The stages are open for rent. We have contract with ILM to do their work for X number of years since this division or sale took place, and we're starting to get work from the rest of the film community down in L.A.
I mean, in some respects, I know it doesn't make sense, but you could almost have say that that you know, if the dice had rolled the other way, you could still be called ILM, and then the guys that moved away to the Presidio could have been called something else, because it really is a continuation for what was happening there.
Absolutely, this is, the ILM started with what we have and where we are, and yeah, you easily could have done that.
And
other than that beautiful logo and name that George owns.
Yeah, sure, of course. And so the really great thing, I guess, from a general point of view for the effects community is that in many respects, if you're looking at this from an outsider's point of view, all of a sudden somebody else has access to what was ILM's famous model shop in, you know, in blunt terms. That somebody else can now basically access what was previously the insides of ILM's model division.
Well, that's the really exciting thing for us. I mean, to me, not being a model maker, but being a photographer and a DP for years, and this is what I say to each and every one of our model department, they are the best model shop in the world. And I really do believe that. And now, no slight on anyone else, now every other film in the world can use the best model shop in the world. So that's pretty neat. And, you know, we're really looking forward to working on more and better and new and different films.
Not that you haven't had a good run to date. My God, the list of Academy Award nominated and Academy Award winning films that you guys have worked on is astounding.
I guess miniatures have evolved over the years, at least since Star Wars. They used to be what we euphemistically called ships on sticks. You know, that's what you saw in Star Wars in motion control. Single frame a second photography generally, and moving a camera instead of an object or a spaceship. And from that, you know, CG sort of has taken over, and they do what they call hard body objects so well. But it's those things that that move, that need scale, and that's exactly it. I call it the elements, or conquering the elements, and it really comes down to earth, wind, fire, water. When you have those things that are involved in your shot, there's no better way than to do them with a miniature. Sometimes even doing them full size is too impractical or too dangerous, and it's much safer and better. And each of those elements kind of has their threshold. For instance, fire, you don't like to go below quarter scale, but we've done it at 8th scale, and with enough kind of finesse and experience, there's ways to break a flame up to make it look proper. Water, you really don't like to go below 3rd scale if you can help it.
So let's discuss those limiting factors, because I think it's quite interesting. It's probably, if I'm sticking my neck out here, but I'm thinking it's gravity, because obviously gravity doesn't scale. Surface tension with water, because that's one of the things that creates the properties of... clearly the function of heat rising, causing flame, smoke, etc., to rise and billow at particular rates, which is related to air pressure. And so it's basically trying to manage those sort of elemental things in relationship to how big or small you can afford to make and safely make I think miniature is the wrong word, but, you know, let's call it a miniature.
Sure. Well, it's not a full-size, you know, office building if it's 30 stories. But, you know, you're exactly right. There is reality. There's ways to conquer gravity, but there's other things, momentum and inertia, that, you know, you conquer gravity by overcranking the camera. You know, if something's a 12th scale, you'll overcrank to X speed, and there's a factor for figuring that out. And that'll generally give you the amount of time it takes something to fall. The example is always a 10-foot car going up a 100-foot cliff, and it needs to fall. In real time, it'd fall over this. Well, if it's a scale down by a tenth, it's a 10-foot cliff, and, of course, it'll fall way too quick, so you overcrank the camera. But beyond just sort of the math of it, there's this thing that happens with inertia, momentum, and just general movement that starts to betray itself. And really the key is believability. It's when does, you know, you cross that threshold of believability. And through experience, you learn those things. And it isn't just gravity in the case of falling. Or with flame as a good example, you know, a flame will burn the way it is, and it's very hard to build a miniature flame. It's virtually impossible. What we'll do is try to break it up with wind. with water will try to break up the surface tension. One of the tricks is to use a certain detergent on the surface so that it doesn't have the same surface tension. And, you know, the threshold really is more believability than any one other physical thing. So,
and of course, it's lighting as well, isn't it? Because what really makes a big difference is, in your area, just getting the light right on these models.
Well, you know, lighting, of course, is important in a miniature. Lighting's important in a film. If you saw, you know, a great example is when you watch a film and it just looks gorgeous and you're in the world, and then you watch the making of or something, and you've got a video camera that's a little bit off axis and it hasn't been processed or filtered or balanced the way a DP will go in and take his other footage and balance. And you can you instantly see, gee, that's not as evocative as the film I just watched, you know. So lighting's hugely important to all aspects of film. Lighting's incredibly important to effects. One of the things we talked about at Seagraph was a film like AI where we went underwater, where really that trick, and I know perhaps we can talk about it now, but the lighting is what made it really work, the fact that we felt underwater. Now, it also not only felt underwater, it hopefully created a mood, and there was a mood in the story that was, you know, well-defined, and the lighting wanted to help that.
I mean, I think the underwater stuff in AI was breathtaking. It was some of the nicest work in the whole film, and I think there are several things that you've touched on there. I mean, also the movement of the camera. It had the feeling that the camera was moving through a fluid. There was nothing that sort of broke that illusion. But also there were things like particles that were seen to be drifting in the water between us and the... And I'm are those particles added in post? And if they are, is that the sort of a good point to be talking about a merger between practical and digital?
Oh, it's a great point. In those that few minute sequence, it's all there. Just sort of to recap, the basic sets were built, I think, 12th scale, and they spanned maybe, you know, 30 feet wide by 60, 70 feet deep, several buildings. One of them with Geppetto's workshop was a bigger scale because we were right inside it. But the technique we call it is dry for wet. So that set is lit with rows of lights stacked almost right next to each other, par lights on trellises that can be moved around or tracks and gelled to a certain color and all run through a dimmer. And so, and then heavily smoked. And all that really lighting in that shot is just backlit smoke. And then occasionally we'd use a little bit of edge light to pick something else up we might want to see, as long as it didn't feel too lit. So there's a balance in lighting that, as I like to think of it, is, and it's a little bit obvious, but you want the audience's eye to go somewhere on that screen. And that light's goal is to make your eye go there. And the reason it goes there is it helps tell the story. Maybe it hides something else. Maybe it vignettes something. Every DP, full size or miniature, should be operating under that premise of making the story be told the way they want it to be told. So, you know, the basic lighting in that is kind of obvious because, you know, without the backlit and the smoke, it wouldn't look underwater. It gives it that haze and that murk, and you can completely control it. You can, as you sit at the eyepiece, you can tip a light up or down ever so slightly, and it completely alters the look. On that particular show, we never wanted to light everything. We always wanted to feel like it was a dark and a light. And that was really a decision that was made by us given what was happening with the live action and you know, trying to really get in the mindset, or not even the mindset, but the gut of the live action DP. What's he doing? What is this film about? And really feeling that and making that happen and using light and dark to create depth and interest and vastness. There's great utility in dark areas as there are in light areas. So, you know, that's an obvious area where lighting sculpts, defines an image. It really doesn't have a whole lot in that case to do with miniature lighting, which other example, or a great way to paraphrase miniature work is the smaller the light, the smaller the pools, things tend to look bigger. You know, the sun only reflects in a shiny car as a little spot in the car, but if you take a big 20K on it from only 30 feet away, it'll reflect much bigger. So you're always trying to use very small units, but yet still have the illumination you need. So getting back to AI, the particles were all CG. The murk was backlit smoke. the particles that you catch in the copter's headlights were all added in CG. The seaweed that's flowing and moving was all added in CG. Those were animation elements that were glued on to wherever it felt appropriate. And then, of course, the motion you talked about of the camera was almost always in the copter, or it was not always, but it wanted to feel like it was underwater. So that was up to the feel and of the motion control operator, because that was all shot probably at one frame a second. Of course, that's a trick in smoke, is, smoke's always moving. So when you do a set like that, you double seal every door and you smoke it, and the shots take 10, 15 minutes. So you really need to lay your smoke in and let it settle and be aware of that, because, of course, at one frame a second, if you see it move, it'll look aberrantly too fast. So that's a nutshell sort of that.
And I guess there is a minor ignorant perception that there's some hostility between miniatures and digital. But in fact, digital frees up miniature work, doesn't it? Because you've got wire removal and a whole lot of things that previously, restricted what you could do.
A lot of, in the past, even some of the stuff I said we did digitally, we've also done practically. We've put seaweed or miniature seaweed in a cloud tank and shot as a separate element. And it could have been done that way. So it does free you up. It frees up everyone. It's the compositing is, if you'd seen Seagraph, I don't know if I really pointed this out, but we showed a history reel. And, there are phenomenal films at the time, E.T., Star Wars. But the compositing today just blows that stuff away. It's really better. But it's not that you couldn't do that in a practical manner. Once again, we've done it. But there's a utility as a facility. And you have resources. In a company where ILM, in this case for AI, someone said, well, we've got this many CG artists and we've got this many miniature artists. How can we best get ourselves through this process? And, that choice isn't just how, it's the ease of how and the resources at hand. So it does free everyone up that we can use any technique we can think of. It is really great.
Well, let's get back to something that really merged digital and practical very well in Pearl Harbor. And I want to discuss in your Earth, Wind, Fire thing, obviously the ships, the battleships and stuff that were getting bombed had CGI, but also there was just amazing, very large-scale miniatures on that. And one of the things that I was astounded by was hearing the level of detail, like on, say, the deck planking on some of those ships. Can you maybe discuss the level of detail and sophistication that goes into those models?
Well, the large 28-foot battleship for the Arizona that was sunken at Pearl Harbor is, if you could have seen that model, and it doesn't exist because we used it above and below water, and by the time it ended up underwater, it was completely, bombed and destroyed. So It tragically doesn't exist as it once did, but it was a beautiful model, and it was built to a level of detail that was stunning. The wood planks, of course, were scaled and put in by hand. Everything was just perfect on the ship, and it sort of, was stunning. It was a really beautiful ship.
As a DOP filming that, there must be a moment of pause, like serious pause, because you don't have 10 of those for 10 takes, right?
No. In this case, you had one, and it was originally intended to be multiple ships, and there were top pieces that were removable, and we could sort of scale the hull up and down by the pieces that went on it. It's not exactly how it was used in the film, ultimately. As things happen, things change, but that one model was a very expensive, one-of-a-kind model.
So are there points at which, I can't imagine how angst it must be to blow up something like that and then not know whether you've got it. If you're shooting on film, it's...
Well, here's an evolution, and it's an interesting one. We always used to build three of anything we were going to blow up. And the evolution is a financial one. And I don't know what it is. The budgets have gotten bigger, but our end always seems to get tighter, even though there's more money probably involved because of the cost of money. But we've got to a point where on Van Helsing, we said we should build three, and they said, okay, you can build two. And we insisted on testing a piece, so that a producer decided was one of them. Said, well, that's all you've got now, or you just used up one of them. So there is a squeeze that you're getting down to one take only. And that may be a kind of a testament of our ability and skill. And then someone sees, gee, it worked in one, let's just build one. But it's certainly not the most prudent way. But
it must really come down to experience, though, because the whole reason that we want to blow up something as a miniature is to get the organic nature and the unpredictability of it. So to a certain extent, we're relying on the talent of the artist to guess very accurately where that debris is going to go, how big the fireball is going to be, etc.
There's no question. Talent, experience, kind of gut feel, where do you put the camera, where is it going to work best? We're working on a show right now, and I recently saw some boards, and there was a house that someone put in that was sort of too close. And I said, gee, you know what if that was a one-story house right there instead of a two-story? Because being two-story, it put it right up at camera level. And I thought, that's just the wrong place, too, to put a miniature, because it'll give itself away quicker. And also the nature of what's happening in the shot, this event that's coming at the camera, that'll obscure the stuff beyond it, which is still in the frame at that point. So, yeah, experience, artistry, both those things are huge. And they allow you to start to be much better and get away with fewer takes. An interesting thing, too, is in the digital world, you were asking about that, it is easier, and you do learn the tricks. For instance, I know I talked about this before, but in that collapse of the windmill in Van Helsing, that was designed to built up on an 8-foot deck to fall into the ground because of the story point that there's a cavern that's been covered over and one of the monsters lives in there. Well, that's what we wanted to do, but because something got caught up, it only fell 3/4 of the way. And rather than say, we blew it, we got to do another one, we scrambled and realized with today's compositing, the fact that the camera, there was a camera move, but it was repeatable, we could just repeat it and rig that with more pyro and this lump that had only fallen 3/4 of the way down and pull the rest of it. And knowing that digital, we can take, blend, morph, add other explosions over the scene and make these two parts come together and appear as one. And that's something that in the optical days would have been a lot harder to do. Digital, you could get right in there and study exactly this, what's happening on a screen.
And can we discuss cameras for a second? Because I'm really fascinated. There's obviously a move to digital cinematography, and there's a lot of issues that that presents for a company like Kerner Optical, both positive and negative. I guess to start with, if you're shooting single frames, like you were saying before, maybe it's one frame every second or every minute or something, then digital stills photography has opened up very high resolution, high quality stuff. I'm presuming you can use that.
Well, it's interesting. Here, maybe we're the first, because it was one of the first films, but it was episode 2 that we used, George used on the live-action early iterations of HD cameras, the Sony 900. And we used them here on the miniature and effects work. And that was a real challenge. Interestingly enough, the only films that we've really done HD are the two George Lucas Star Wars films, episode 2 and 3. And it was a huge evolution. On the first one, however many years ago that is, about six or seven, the cameras only shot at 24p, was what everyone wanted, 24 frames a second. And the cameras only shot at 24p. And to shoot motion control, I use the phrase motion control speeds, which is roughly 1/4 second to 2 seconds. That's the bulk of the work is, I'm talking about exposures, 1/4 second exposure up to 2 seconds is the bulk of motion control work. So the camera's moving very slow and photographing stuff. Of course, the reason is to get the depth of field, shooting long exposure times, deep f-stops. Well, on episode 2, the camera would not shoot it one frame a second or anything next to it. It shot at 24 frames a second. And what we'd do is still shoot at those speeds because we couldn't always move the camera faster. Our motion control rigs just weren't designed to have the repeatability with stepper motors to go at 24. But what we had to do is light everything to 24 frames a second. And then we pulled frames. We had calculations that said, well, if we're pulling 23 frames, we have to pull 23 frames, and the camera would move at the proper speed, and then in post we'd do that. But we're still exposing at 24, so lights, sets were lit to incredibly bright, hot exposures. That evolved during episode 3, where we were able to through a lot of finessing with the internals of the camera, take and basically expose those cameras at 1 or 2 frames a second. And that helped a lot. On episode 2, we had to shoot things in a lot of planes because we wouldn't have 30 feet of depth of field. So I shot something for the Clone Factory that was basically a back wall and several towers. And they were all lit with internal grain of wheat lights and a lot of very small units, all colored up and down lighting as if there was another world somewhere else. And we'd sort of shoot these towers in 4 or 5 planes with a blue screen between each one because he simply couldn't hold the depth of field.
But isn't it the case if you're shooting that if you're shooting digital and you go for a long exposure, you increase the noise as opposed to in film? Obviously, long exposure sort of tends to decrease the grain.
Well, you get grain. You get reciprocity with film over a certain time, and it's a warming that you can take out. It doesn't affect grain much. You certainly get noise, and we played with still cameras, everything that was available at the time, and decided that this was the best way to go because of other reasons. You know, everything had a little problem one way or another. It was either storage capacity. Today, people are using still cameras very effectively to do moving shots, you know, on some of the stop-motion movies that are being done. And they're still cameras, and that's how they're designed. And so
let's say that the script calls for some kind of explosion, clearly an outdoor setup, so it's You've got 60,000 square feet of studio there, but also you've got the slab outside, right? Which I think is where you built that quarter of a million tank thing for Pirates 3. Yeah,
exactly. A lot of things.
but out there, if you wanted to do something using natural light, I'm trying to limit it down so you can get a sensible answer. but what sort of film stocks for outdoor daylight explosion car scale things? I mean, do you have preferences on film stocks? Do you just shoot standard, or is it shooting what the production's shooting to match, or do you?
Well, the whole film stock question is interesting. It's mildly interesting because it's just a film stock. A lot's made out of it, and most film stocks you can in post make it look like anything. Really, that's my belief. And we always use Kodak. It's just the film stock we use. It's been around. It's evolved. One of the great things Kodak came up with some years ago, and they've sort of gone past that, was an ASA. They called it FX 200, and it was really great for blue screen work. And that's evolved into the newer Kodak stock. So there's not a real specific stock. You always try to get the finest grain you can because you know you can degrade it. Sometimes outside, because of the angle of the light, you'll have to use the higher speed daylight stock, a 200. But now the 85 filter is built into the stock, so you always use one of the two, ASA 50 or 200, 250 daylight stock. Just shooting outside in itself is kind of an interesting little side note. Being kind of a heavy motion control based company for many years, and this stuff was bolted down and laser leveled, and we worried more about things getting bumped than moving it. Back on episode 1, the decision was made to move outside. Let's take what we've done for years, motion control, and let's use natural lighting because, you know, there's nothing better than the sun. You don't need multiple units. You're not flagging off areas to make it look right. And that was kind of a big breakthrough here at Kerner Van ILM, was to make stuff more portable and move it outside on a daily basis. So now we're on a daily basis setting up a new shot in sunlight with blue screens, and we learned about the wind and conquering, you know, the wind against with a blue screen and setting a motion control track up and picking it up and putting it down and getting a shot very quickly, quicker than we ever had in the past. So that was the desire to use daylight instead of lighting a set really changed our outlook on photography here. How we used motion control, we've gone, everything is more portable and has wheels, and we learned how to level and land and support very quickly. And it's helped because, you know, there's not, as you said earlier, there's nothing better than the sun if it's supposed to be in the sun.
Actually, that reminds me of an anecdote you told at SIDGRAPH about that episode, I think it was episode 1, set of the, I think it was the flowers built into the set. And some insects problems. Do you know?
Yeah, right.
Maybe you could tell us that.
Sure. Going back to episode 1, when we first moved outside, to shoot stuff, the first thing that was going to be outside ever in this sort of way of a motion control shot was the city of Theed for episode one. And Theed is a beautiful planet that's covered with flowers. And the flowers are in the terrain, and they're in the flower boxes, and they're on the roofs. And at a certain point, these flowers in this scale of building were just, some clever model maker had the idea of, hey, let's use colored cake sprinkles. And they were great. They gave you another level of scale of flower, and it really helped broaden things. Well, the night everything was dressed and they were put in an indoor stage, and we'd move them out that, you know, for security reasons, we'd move them out the day we're going to shoot. So they're already dressed. We go home, come back in the morning, and the last of the cake sprinkles was being carried away by ants that feasted all night on these cake sprinkles.
Well, that's it. I just want to say thanks to Marty for doing that. Hope to see as many of you as we can at the FX 2012 event at the 3210 Studios, though I have to say places are extremely limited. We only have a very, very small number of places that we can have, and many of those have already gone, but hopefully you can still get in before it's sold out. I'm Mike Seymour. On behalf of my partners, Jeff Huser and John Montgomery, I'll see you next time.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.